This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Anthony Brooks is out today. More than 85,000 people are still without power almost a week after the surprise October storm. After tornadoes, a tropical storm, and now a nor'easter, for some Massachusetts residents, the weeks of bad weather are really starting to pile higher than the snow.
Those areas like Springfield, for whatever reason, they've had an awful year, and they've been in the center of the target, since June 1st.
Meanwhile, presidential candidate Herman Cain is battling a storm of his own.
I've never sexually harassed anyone, and yes, I was falsely accused while I was at the National Restaurant Association.
Plus, the state legislature votes to raise the retirement age for public employees, and 2 months into the school year, the buses in Boston are still arriving late for class. Well, joining us now to review the week's news is Joan Vinocki, columnist for the Boston Globe. Hi there, Joan.
Nice to be here again.
Great to have you back. And Kyle Chaney, reporter for the State House News Service. Great to have you too, Kyle. Welcome back.
Hi there.
So let's start with the big weather story here in New England. We heard just a moment ago Peter Judge from the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency talking about how some communities in central and western Massachusetts have just been hit again and again this year. So here's a little bit more from him describing the situation this morning.
The Connecticut River Valley line, if you will, from south to north, is probably the most problematic at this particular point anyway, although there are literally pockets everywhere from Essex County to the Berkshires.
So Kyle and Joan, I have a friend who lives just outside of Amherst, and she posted on Facebook today that the community has been traumatized. Let me first ask you, how did the two of you weather this surprise fall storm?
Eastern Massachusetts sort of escaped the brunt of it. I feel like we were a little lucky in that way, as we were in some of the previous weather incidents, too. So I can't complain personally.
Very little trauma by my side. Some cracked tree branches, but nothing serious compared to what is going on in other parts of the state, that's for sure.
It is remarkable how different the experiences were sort of east, central, and west across the state of Massachusetts. I mean, the further away you go from the Boston area, we're seeing power companies and their response to the storm come under a lot of scrutiny. And that was even before we heard the news of an 86-year-old woman who was found dead in her home, wrapped in a blanket. And she died apparently due to hypothermia in North Brookfield. So, Joan, let me ask you, do you think power companies were up to the task of handling the storm, and are they deserving of the criticism they've been receiving this week?
I think they do deserve the criticism. This has developed into a huge public relations problem for them, and I don't think they understood it, the situation quickly enough. And if they are doing what needs to be done, they didn't get that message across to people. And it's also developed into a big political headache, I think, for Governor Deval Patrick. He came out early saying they were doing a terrific job, and now he's kind of backpedaled and said he's lost patience. I think it took him too long to get impatient.
Kyle, do you feel the same way?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you wonder if this latest fatality is going to be sort of the turning point in this crisis to really get people fired up about doing something about this, because this is, as you mentioned, there's been a string of just awful and unusual weather crises that and each time the utilities have come under fire, and each time it's sort of like history repeating itself.
I have to say, a tropical storm is one thing. Tornadoes are also one thing. But a nor'easter, you'd think that we as a region would be able to bear it. And utilities by this time, they, sort of should have this really set. They should know what to do when a storm like this hits. It just surprises me that so many tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people had to suffer so much yet again. Do you sense, Joan, that there'll be any tipping point here in terms of political pressure that will ultimately be put on the utilities to not let this happen again?
Well, to pick up on what Kyle said, the question is, what will they do? They'll hold hearings. There'll be a panel of people, hauling in the utilities, I expect, to explain what they did wrong and what went wrong. But what action comes out of it, I'm not sure any will. And it, will be up to the public to get outraged enough to require that. A little bit has come out now about the really high salaries and the millions paid to the CEOs of these utilities. And Brian McGrory shown a very strong light on that.
That's right.
The state approves the rates. Implicit in those rates is approval of the salaries, I think. So it seems like it's a fair question to ask. Are people getting what they pay for?
Joan, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I was actually just going to give a shout out.
No, I want to credit to Brian McGrory as well.
Yeah, because I think he's the one who highlighted that Tom May, the head of NSTAR, was getting something like $8 million a year. So, Kyle, let me ask you, I mean, as Joan pointed out, it's a somewhat regulated industry. So does that mean that the state, if it wants to, can actually just demand changes right now?
The state can absolutely demand changes. I think, you know, if you recall the 2008 ice storm out in almost the same area that got hit hard out in central Mass, they passed legislation here at the State House that they said was going to prevent exactly this kind of thing, or at least provide some recourse if it happens again to really punish the utilities. So we'll see if that legislation actually comes into play here, or if it actually went far enough to help out in a situation that now is happening again.
I think it's surprising that the politicians have been so slow to pick up on this. I think one of the first to really express outrage was Scott Brown, and you know, everyone else has kind of come in wagging their tail after he came out first, but they still haven't said what they'll do.
Well, I mean, as you pointed out, there maybe hasn't been as much outrage as there could have or should have been, but as you go out to the towns that are actually still suffering, the outrage is definitely there. We've got some voices here to demonstrate that. This is Patrick Brady. He is chairman of the Board of Selectmen in the town of Wilbraham. He's got kind of a counterintuitive view, even though 50% of the people in his town still don't have power.
And I find it funny that people are criticizing National Grid at a time when they need National Grid the most. It's kind of like yelling at your waiter bringing you the food. That's just not smart.
Well, after 5 days of no power, maybe even the most patient among us would yell. Governor Deval Patrick, who said, as Joan pointed out, finally, that the utilities have to step up. And Attorney General Martha Coakley has now also launched a formal investigation into the power company's response to the storm. So let's listen to her for a little bit.
Looking at where they marshaled their resources, what kind of money are they putting into infrastructure maintenance, leaf and tree cutting, as well as the preparedness with personnel, is something that we need to look at.
Joan, that seems to reflect what you were saying, that a lot of looking but maybe no action.
Right. I'm also surprised at the governor's slowness to respond. I mean, for those of us who live in sort of the eastern part of the state, anything that happens beyond 128 is really someone else's problem. But he actually has a home out in western Massachusetts and has a lot more contact with that part of the state than some more Boston-centric people do. So it's a little bit surprising to me.
Well, if we can, let's move on to the world of politics, and particularly the race for the GOP presidential primary. The big story this week was the sexual harassment allegations surrounding candidate Herman Cain. The allegations date back to the 1990s when Cain was the chief of the National Restaurant Association. Now, Cain has acknowledged that these allegations existed. He insists they were baseless, and the reporting first came out of Politico on Sunday, and Politico reported that two instances of harassment led to paid severance packages, one of which was reported to be a year's salary. So that's the background to the story. Kyle, do you sense that any of these sexual harassment allegations could be damaging to Cain's candidacy?
I mean, it certainly can't help him. That's for sure. And, interestingly and ironically enough, Politico is also reporting today that one of the settlements came on $9.99, which just sort of adds a little insult to injury there. But
referencing his $9.99.
Yes, exactly. And so, it obviously can't help him. The question is, it seems like some GOP voters are rallying behind him and saying, treating this as sort of an attack on his character to tear him down. But assuming he could be a real player in a general election, do these charges stick? It may be different for a general electorate than it is for his base.
Joan, your first thoughts on the Cain controversy?
Well, my first thoughts are that I don't think Herman Cain is going to be the Republican Party nominee, and that it really doesn't have anything to do with these particular allegations. I had a somewhat different reaction than other people did. I thought the first Politico story was kind of weakly sourced, to be quite honest. Anonymous sources, no specifics on what exactly happened. Cain mishandled the whole thing terribly, and it stretched out to be, a 5-day story now. And it doesn't help him in any way. But again, I don't think it's going to be the main reason why he's not the party nominee.
Well, Herman Cain has actually blamed The campaign of Rick Perry, Texas Governor Rick Perry, says that someone from his campaign leaked the story based on the fact that a partner in the Perry campaign, and I guess the consulting firm that's working with the campaign, was at one time a Cain consultant during Herman Cain's 2003 Senate run. So a lot of movement between consultants in campaigns here. That's totally standard for presidential races. But the point is that Rick Perry says, no way, his campaign did not leak this to Politico, and he would fire anyone if they leaked the story. Here's a little bit more from Texas Governor Rick Perry.
If you're passing on rumors that are that heinous, that bad, you don't need to be working with me. Gone.
Joan, here's what I wonder. Is this a sense of just sort of standard presidential season infighting, or could this be an indication that even though you said there's no way Herman Cain's going to win the GOP nomination, that people are nervous enough to see him as even a somewhat of a threat to try and undermine his campaign?
Well, you know, I guess my second reaction was that somebody leaked it to Politico and somebody wanted the story out. And Cain has, you know, stayed higher in the polls than most people thought he would. He clearly is seen as a threat and, you know, someone who is taking attention away from other people's campaigns. So, I mean, I could say he's not going to be the nominee. And, you know, I guess if I'm wrong, I'll have to come on your program and say that I'm wrong. There was, you know, the whole week now has been consumed with the controversy. I think overall it's been a good week for Barack Obama.
Hmm. Kyle Cheney, some people in the Kerry campaign, if I understand correctly, they're pointing suddenly over to the campaign of former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, saying, hey, look, he had supporters in the National Restaurant Association, kind of a quick look over their move. Is this a moment where Mitt Romney just sort of hovers over the fray and ends up looking more potentially presidential?
I don't think anybody could come out looking good if they start getting into this the sort of recriminations and the back and forth finger pointing on this one. I also think Perry's sort of an easy target because he's known as sort of a tear-down kind of campaigner, sort of a tough, sort of go-negative kind of campaigner. So it's not a surprise that he's the first one to sort of take the blame and that, of course, he'd want to deflect that somewhere else to the other perceived front-runner, who was Mitt Romney.
Hmm. Well, I want to dive a little bit deeper into something that Joan said about the polling that's going on right now. Herman Cain's polling numbers apparently have continued to rise through this controversy. There's a Washington Post ABC poll that was conducted after Politico first reported those allegations on Sunday. Now, in that poll, Herman Cain and Mitt Romney were neck and neck at the top of the GOP pack. Okay, so that's one thing. Kyle, your first response to that.
Well, I wonder if that says something about the state of the regard for the media in one sense. I think especially, though, if you look at among the GOP base, I think the media tends to be it's a target for everybody, but especially on the Republican side, it's become very much sort of a whipping boy for whenever candidates come under attack or receive any negative coverage. And so in some ways you could get the base fired up when you get a negative story. It could help as much as it hurts, at least within the Republican electorate.
But Joan, just north of us in New Hampshire, there's a very different picture regarding the polling. Mitt Romney continues to really dominate there, as he has for quite some time, 20 points ahead of Herman Cain, who is still his nearest competitor in New Hampshire. So no change really in up in the Granite State. But now, since we know that the primary is going to be held on January 10th, is maybe the story in New Hampshire not just who might come in second if Mitt Romney does win, but how close they come to Romney?
Is that first poll you referenced a national poll?
It's a Washington. Yeah, it's a ABC Washington Post ABC national poll. Yeah.
So, I mean, in the end, the national polls really don't matter as much as what happens state by state, mm-hmm. caucus by caucus. And, I agree with what Kyle said. Probably the polling does show the regard for the media and lack thereof. And it also shows this reluctance to embrace Romney as the candidate. Different, obviously, in New Hampshire, which is another one of his home states and which, you know, he looks to, you know, clearly be ahead in right now. But I suppose if somebody comes in a strong second in a place that's supposed to be his home base, where he's so far ahead right now, that somebody, you know, could be trouble for him down the road.
Kyle, do you feel the same way that Mitt Romney has to make it a super home run, like a grand slam up in New Hampshire?
People absolutely read into it if it's closer than it should be, or, you know, I think everyone expects Romney to turn out a really strong performance in New Hampshire. But yeah, no, there's definitely some. It can only hurt Romney in a sense because he's expected to do so well there. that if it even doesn't do as well as they think he will, then, of course, it could provide momentum to somebody else.
Mm. We've got a couple more stories to hit before we wrap up our week in review. Let's move on to a question about the retirement age for state workers. This week, the House of Representatives in the Massachusetts legislature passed a plan to raise the retirement age for public workers from 55 to 57, which they estimate will save the state some $6.4 billion over the next 30 years. The Senate, meanwhile, wants to up the age to 60 years old. The House bill, it passed unanimously. Kyle, let's start with you. I mean, you're there every single day. Does this seem like a big deal? And a unanimous passing does seem significant.
It's a huge deal because this is really sort of the real meat of the pension system now. It's not just sort of tinkering around the edges with some of the sort of loopholes and the glaring things that people have gotten into trouble over. This is sort of at the heart of the pension system. And the pension system is billions of dollars sort of in need of additional funding over the next projected 20 to 30 years. So this is cutting a huge chunk away from what they're going to need to fund that pension system. And it's never a sexy issue in particular, but it's definitely substantive, I would say that.
Joan?
I agree that it is a big deal, and it's taken them a while. They've been dragged kicking and screaming to reality that they have to address this, and it isn't going away. It's they can look to other states and see what's happening, and they're either going to face the problem and deal with it, or face the music, and it's not going to be very pleasant.
Kyle, with this unanimous passage of the House bill, does that mean that there was no resistance from any state employee union at all?
I mean, the unions are certainly skeptical of anything that they think would take away or reduce benefits for current and future employees. In general, this bill affects only people who will join the workforce, state workforce, in the future. People who are already in the system aren't necessarily going to be bear the brunt of some of these changes. I can't say that they're excited about it. There was much more opposition over on the Senate side, but I think they're biding their time a little bit, and they'll respond at some point.
And sorry, Joan, do I hear you there?
I was just going to say that it does play out. This part of it isn't sexy, but it plays out against the sort of the outrages and scandals of these some huge pensions that people have gotten, and I think it's become harder to stop reform because of the, frankly, a lot of the stories that the Boston Globe has written.
Mm-hmm. And just the sense and maybe the reality of people who aren't state employees' lives that even being able to retire at 57 wouldn't be such a bad thing, I wonder. Well, in the last couple minutes we have left, why don't we just wrap up today with our hubbubs? And those, of course, are the stories that maybe didn't make it to the top of the fold, but still worth talking about. So, Joan, you want to start with yours?
Well, I would like to start with something that I only know because Kyle Chaney of the State House News Service wrote about it. And that is that the conference committee that's hammering out the casino legislation is once again behind closed doors, which is not a good thing for the public. And secondly, that State Representative Joseph Wagner, who heads the House negotiations, to hammer out the differences between the two versions of the bill, is reluctant to make legislators wait a year before they can go on to the happy landing of a career in the gambling industry, because he says he doesn't want to deprive the industry of the best and the brightest. And that had to be the quote of the week. Wow. From a Massachusetts lawmaker.
Kyle, do you want to tell us a little bit more about that? That is an interesting story.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, Joe Wagner, who's leading the gambling negotiations for the House, is not, he may not win too many friends outside the building necessarily with a comment like that, but what he's trying to do is say, look, we've never in our history passed legislation to block legislators from joining the private sector in any capacity. There are certain rules about how long you have to wait before you can lobby. But right now, this would be the first ever, according to them, attempt to bar legislators from joining a certain private sector industry, regardless of what industry it is.
Hmm. Well, what's your hubbub then, Kyle?
Mine is a little different, although it is somewhat related to gambling. In the Senate, they've adopted an amendment to the gambling bill that dealt with that some people thought would reopen the door to happy hour in Massachusetts. The amendment was sponsored by Robert Hedlund, who did not deny that. He was not looking for happy hours to return here. But actually, this week, He cited, following a little bit of a backlash from people who were worried about reopening the door to happy hour, he has actually sort of backed off that amendment a little bit and said, you know what, rather than allow bars and restaurants to offer free drinks like casinos would be able to, let's have our alcoholic beverages regulators study the issue for a year.
More studies,
but this is one that they say, you know, they say hasn't really been touched in a long time and is due for some sort of overhaul. If it's not open, it's not necessarily reopening happy hour, but maybe there's some changes that need to be made to help bars and restaurants be competitive.
Well, my hubbub has to do with two things. My hubbub has to do with the MBTA, and I know we kind of bring them up quite a bit here on Radio Boston. But given the fact that we heard today that the T said it's going to cut back future service every time there's a big storm, I'm sure that's already making a lot of T riders really grouchy. But apparently, so many people get grouchy or angry with MBTA employees that assaults, particularly where riders or T users spit on MBTA employees, are so bad now that T police officers are going to take the samples of the spittle. I'm hoping I'm not grossing anybody out too much here, and check and do a DNA analysis and use that as evidence.
Are there serial spitters out there? Is that what they're trying to find?
There may be. Apparently, there's been more than 80 attacks on MBTA employees already this year, and more than a quarter of them also included spit. So,
you mean their civility campaign isn't working? the posters aren't enough to get people to be nice to tea workers?
Apparently, they are not having an effect on folks who are ready to, well, let the spit fly, if I can use that horrible pun. Joan Vinocchi, columnist for the Boston Globe, great to have you as always. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Kyle Chaney, reporter for the State House News Service. Wonderful to have you on Radio Boston. Have a great weekend, Kyle.
Thanks, Magna.
Well, in a moment, we will have a eulogy for a legendary Boston retailer. And a little later, Northeastern University looks south and west to develop a new hybrid model for higher education. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.